Support for the Lincoln Project podcast comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who've switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Lincoln. That's odoo.com/Lincoln. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before I get started, I know you've already downloaded the episode because you're listening to it. But before you just get back to what you're doing, take a look at the episode description for each show. It'll give you more background on our guest, on their work, whether or not that's a book or a website or a Substack, or any of the information that we reference during the show. It'll give you that extra context you need to not only listen and understand, but also go spread the pro-democracy gospel. Thanks, everybody, and on with the show. Welcome back to The Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by Imran Ahmed, the CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or CCDH. CCDH is an organization whose mission is to protect human rights and civil liberties online, particularly by holding social media companies accountable. Speaking of accountability, the center is currently being sued by Elon Musk and X, formerly known as Twitter, in an attempt to silence their work exposing the rise of hate on the platform. Imran is an authority on social and psychological malignancies on social media, such as identity-based hate, extremism, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. He was inspired to start the center after seeing the rise of anti-Semitism in the UK and the murder of his colleague, Joe Cox, a member of parliament, by a white supremacist who had been radicalized in part online during the EU or Brexit referendum in 2016. He holds an MA in social and political sciences from the University of Cambridge and is coming to us today live from Washington, D.C. Imran, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, there's a lot there, a lot to get through, but let's begin at the beginning. So you're from the UK. You were involved in the Labour Party over there. So let's zoom out of Washington, D.C. for just a few minutes in the U.S. and take us back to the UK and tell us how you got your start.
Sure. So I mean, I started working in politics in 2009. The first decade of my career had actually been in investment banking and management consultancy. And then something happened that changed my understanding of the world around me. That was 9/11. And I realized, you know, I'm from this privileged generation that never grew up with the Cold War. We never grew up with external threats. And 9/11 made me really aware that the world was dangerous. And I wanted to do something about it. I'm sort of a classic elder sibling. I'm the eldest of seven, and I just wanted to get off my ass and do something. And so I went back to university. I went to Cambridge. I studied politics. I got involved in political work and ended up working in Parliament in 2009. I carried on there for 6 years until 2015, when we contested the general election and we lost at the Labour Party. And what happened then was a guy called Jeremy Corbyn took over the Labour Party. Jeremy came from the far left of the party. Actually, he wasn't really part of the party, but, you know, he was a fellow traveller. And he'd spent his time in the wilderness palling around with Islamists, with anti-Semites, with a lot of fringe movements, anti-vaxxers, kind of the fringes of our politics. And when he became leader, he invited them into the party. And it was that year, 2015, at Christmas, my boss was the shadow foreign secretary. The UK Parliament was having a debate on whether or not to take military action against ISIS in Syria, to join the United States in action. The guy that I worked with was very much for it. Jeremy was very much against it because he was against anything that where we might be using force against the friends of the Islamists. And after we won that vote, my side won that vote to go and take that military action, we received thousands of emails and messages in our office, which were basically saying, don't fight the Jews' war for them. And I just thought, crumbs, what on earth is going on? Because it was so identikit, like this weird idea that the war against ISIS was a war for Jews. So that all happened. And, you know, I started to see like weird things happening in my party that were really worrying to me, the sort of the creeping anti-Semitism. 6 months later, we were having the referendum on whether or not we should remain in the European Union.
Brexit.
Yeah, the Brexit referendum, as everyone knows. Britain left the European Union. And look, there was a lot of conspiracism. There was a lot of like people undermining the election integrity, saying that if you vote in pencil, they'll rub it out and put in Remain in pen. There was conspiracy theories that actually the EU was trying to bring in Muslims to destroy the white race, the great replacement theory. And, you know, I just thought, well, where is this all coming from? This is really un-British, I thought. I thought, we're not this kind of country. And then something terrible happened. My colleague, Jo Cox, who was a mother of two and a member of parliament for a constituency called Batley and Spen in the northwest of England, a guy called Thomas Mair shot, stabbed and beat her to death on the streets outside her constituency office. And he'd been radicalized in part online. When he was killing her, he was screaming, "Britain first, death to traitors." And I mean, I talk about this sometimes, but the truth is that it wasn't just the horror of that moment. There was also a degree of shame in my mind, because Britain First was a neo-Nazi movement that was the first political movement in the UK to achieve a million likes on Facebook. It happened a few years earlier. And when it happened, I'd been told about it by a colleague, and I'd said, "Who gives a damn? They've got a million clicktivists. We've got 500,000 members of our party, like paying their dues every month. They're nothing. They're not real." And I was wrong, right? I was just wrong, because most of the conventional institutions, the politics, the media, had not understood the extent to which the primary place where we now share information, where we negotiate our values, where we set our social mores, the norms of attitude and behavior, where we negotiate even what we call facts, has shifted to these online spaces. And they had a different rules of physics to the real world. Actually, disinformation and hate were given more visibility, not less. And that was re-socializing our world. And that's why I set up CCDH, to try and study and understand the way that that was changing things. But also, like right at the beginning, when I said I'm the kind of guy who wants to do something about it, also to work out how we can reverse that. Because I thought it would destroy not just lives, but our democracy itself.
Well, and so much of what you're talking about, between the rise of Corbyn as not as traditional member of the Labour Party, Brexit, all of this stuff, 2015, 2016, is coincident with so much that was happening here in the US at the same time.
You're so right. And of course, it was happening slightly before you guys. And in fact, in 2012, we'd had a referendum on whether or not Scotland should leave the United Kingdom. And that had also been marred by conspiracy theories, lies, disinformation, and hate flowing online. In that instance, it wasn't racial hatred, it was hatred of the English people, but also lies about, you know, secret oil fields that were being hidden by the British government to keep the Scottish enslaved and nonsense like that. So we'd had some form before you. And that also, Reid, is what drove me to understand that this wasn't just about something being wrong with Britain or something being wrong with Corbyn. This is not a Corbyn or a Boris Johnson or an X, Y, or Z problem. This is a systemic problem, because we could look just overseas to our closest friend and ally, the United States, and see the same thing happening there. And then we could look over to Europe and see the same thing happening in Hungary. We could look further afield to the Philippines, to Brazil, and see that there's something happening simultaneously across the world in our information ecosystem, which is driving political change and driving outcomes that are really deeply worrying, that undermine what we thought was an unstoppable passage of history towards more democracy, more liberty, more freedom, and more tolerance.
Right. I mean, so I do remember the Cold War. I think I'm a few years older than you. And the Cold War ends, the Berlin Wall falls, the Soviet Union falls, and this is going to be the golden age of democracy in the world, right? This Pax Democracia, if that's, I'm not good at Latin, Imran, but the idea is, you know, finally, we will preside over millions, if not billions, of voices being freed after all this time. You know, we're going to enter a new epoch. And it turns out that epoch lasts 30 years, for lucky, maybe not even.
Yeah. I mean, you remember, like, there were philosophers like Francis Fukuyama talking about how we were at the end of history, right? And it was Samuel Huntington who wrote the book, The Clash of Civilizations. Fukuyama wrote the book about how this is the end of history, how basically democracy and liberalism, liberalism with a small L, the idea of, you know, tolerance and freedom, that they've won and it's over. Game over, we win. And Huntington said, hold on a second, actually there are civilizations out there which are completely counterpoised to your values, that they are inimical to your values, they're enemies of your values. And of course, what 9/11 did was kind of start to show that there was some wisdom in what Huntington was saying. I mean, some of his thesis was kind of bananas, but, you know, that actually this wasn't the end of history. But what we hadn't realized at that point was that not just were the enemies of democracy and liberalism and the values that and again, small l, I know I'm in America, small l liberalism, that the values of, you know, science, tolerance and everything else, that those enemies weren't just foreign, they were domestic too. And that they would have a new set of armaments given to them by Silicon Valley that would actually allow them to potentially put democracy to the sword.
And we've seen that too. I mean, and we can discuss the work that CCDH has done on this, but there's been plenty of stories about whether or not it's Meta / Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. We can discuss TikTok as well, that the algorithm knows that people get more fired up about the bad stuff, about the bad news, about the ugliness. They share it more, they watch it more, they stay longer. And because it's an algorithm, right, it wants to give you what you're already asking for, and it wants to give you more of what you're asking for.
So by now, we all know that. But in 2016, believe me, when I was telling people what I thought I was seeing, and I'm a mathematician, I'm sort of scientific by training. I went to med school originally and was a maths major at high school. You know, you could see the mathematics of like what was being output. So if you can see the outputs of an algorithm, you can kind of start to guess from the curve what it actually is. And we could see what was being given amplification. And when I was telling people that these online harms were being amplified by the platforms themselves and that actually they were creating offline harm as well, people just kind of went, no, look, it's online and people know the difference and that's just a different world, mate. And I just thought, well, no, that's not true. That's not what we're seeing. That's not what happened to Joe.
Right. It's not what happened to your colleague, Joe. It's not what happened in Buffalo. It's not what happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And this is, I think, one thing, you know, the online world, Imran, is not the real world, but it is real, and it does jump the air gap. The online becomes the analog.
Absolutely, and we found that to be true not just in terms of extremism, but also, so we did a study in December last year which looked at how TikTok's algorithm, if you set up an account as a 13-year-old girl, within 2.6 minutes, it's serving you up self-harm content, within 8 minutes, eating disorder content. Now, you might think, well, you know, this is just stuff that people are seeing. On the board of CCDH is a guy called Ian Russell. Ian Russell's daughter, Molly, was 14 years old when she took her own life. The coroner decided to carry out an inquest into what happened and named Meta, so the parent company of Instagram and Pinterest, as co-respondents on that inquiry. And what they found was she'd been served up so many images of self-harm and eating disorders that it actually normalized the idea that if you hurt inside, you hurt yourself outside. And if you really hurt inside, you really, really hurt yourself outside. You take your own life. And, you know, it can reshape reality. It can reshape reality for everyone. That is undermining so many things that we hold to be important.
Well, and you talked about Instagram, and you can probably relate the exact story. They have known that their algorithm was harmful to teenage girls. They know it, and they do it anyway.
So that's the second part of what we had to teach people. The first part was online harms have got an offline effect. The second part was to explain to them that the platforms aren't just too big. You know, they can't help it because it's too difficult. What we had to prove was that actually they were complicit. It's their algorithms and the way that they run their platforms and enforce their own rules, their own community standards, their failure to enforce those rules that is causing the problem. You know, we did a ton of research which showed that. We showed that even when you report extreme anti-Semitism that's way outside of their rules, they take no action most of the time. We did studies which showed the way that their algorithms actually cross-fertilize conspiracies. So if you're following one conspiracy about, say, QAnon, it would then give you anti-vax content as well because it knows that you're prone to conspiracism. But what really sort of ended the discussion was when Francis Haugen, the whistleblower from Meta, from Facebook, came out and said, hold on, they have internal documents that show the same.
Because they too had created basically an avatar, a middle-aged American woman, and saw that it immediately started feeding her this kind of content as well.
Exactly. And you know what's really funny, Reed, is that one of our research studies was a study of how 12 people produced 2/3 of the disinformation that was shared online. It was called the Disinformation Dozen. It's quite a well-known study, and it led to a lot of change. Now, at the time, Meta said this is just simply untrue. These people are lying. It turned out that on the very same day that our research came out, Francis Haugen revealed that internally they had concluded that a tiny number of people were producing most of the content and the shares on their platform. So they knew that that relationship was true. They knew how it was working. They knew that all the things that people were finding were true, but they chose to ignore it because it was more profitable not to. And that's what it comes down to. This is the economics of inaction. And, you know, that's down to the legal and regulatory framework. It's down to the economics of how these platforms work. And that's what we really have switched to, is understanding, well, now that we understand online harms are real, the platforms are part of the problem, so what next? And we've worked out that the answer is to create costs.
Support for the Lincoln Project podcast comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who've switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Lincoln. That's odoo.com/Lincoln. Odoo, modern management made simple.
I want to go back to the research that you talked about, that you and I discussed last week when we spoke about TikTok and conspiracy theories and 13 to 17 year olds. So tell us about what you guys are learning. We have the presentation that we'll put in the show notes, but go ahead and give us a little bit of a taste of what it is you all found.
So we recently carried out a piece of polling using a firm of 1,000 adults, 1,000 children in both the US and UK. So it's 4,000 people in total. To look at what we were trying to work out, like to what extent is there demand for regulatory change, for legal change, for these platforms to be held accountable under law, to be transparent under law. And as part of the survey, I said we should throw in a raft of conspiracy theory belief questions. So what most people believe lazily is that it's old people that believe conspiracy theories. And that is kind of received wisdom now. Everyone kind of says it's your crazy uncle, you know, who WhatsApps you the crazy thing on the conspiracy theory. What we found was really, really disturbing. The age cohort, so the age group with the highest level of conspiracy belief was actually children, 14 to 17 year olds that we polled. They had substantially higher levels of conspiracy belief than older people. And high use teens, so teens who used social media for more than 5 hours a day, they had even higher levels. So let me give you one statistic. 43% of 14 to 17 year olds we polled think that Jews control the economy and our politics, compared to a substantially lower number of adults. And it goes to a majority of 14 to 17 year olds who use the internet for 5+ hours a day. What that was showing us is that actually the people who've grown up immersed in short-form video platforms like TikTok, like Instagram Reels, like YouTube Shorts, they have a completely skewed sense of reality. And it shouldn't be surprising to us because, of course, when you're young, you don't have that much information and you're being sort of bullet-fed like a machine gun, you know, disinformation after disinformation after disinformation. And that is the most entertaining content, the most engaged with content on that platform. Well, yeah, they have absolutely no idea which way is up and which way is down.
Well, and also, I would say this, I want to use a metaphor, is that it's like a pilot who gets lost in the fog or in the clouds, right? And they can be upside down. They can be inverted without knowing it, right? Because they're not experienced enough, because they don't have the right instrumentation. And for a teenager, right? Especially now, Imran, like, these are the digital natives. I have two of them. They've never known a world without the internet. They've really never been conscious of a world without some sort of social media. So you can see that there's now, you take the ability to do this, you take a place in which so many, not only adults, but teens in particular, are now creating their own worlds. So they're happy to walk through the looking glass like Alice, and they find the Mad Hatter, and they find the Red Queen, you know, and they find the rabbit, right? And it's really hard to pull them back out of it because, I mean, if you're spending 5 hours online, Imran, let's say it's during the school year, you're at school for 8 hours, you sleep for 8 hours. So, you know, that leaves you another 8 hours, then better than 50% of the time you're not occupied otherwise, being in school or asleep, you're looking at this stuff.
So in psychology, this is a term called epistemic anxiety. That is kind of a sense of where you just don't know what's true or not, and you don't feel you know how to work out what's true or not. You're anxious about information. Think of it as a deep yearning for certainty. And all of us know that feeling, right? Like, I'll give you one example of when, I'm telling you, every single person on this planet felt it simultaneously, was at the start of the pandemic, when we were all like, what the heck is going on? And we felt this kind of deep desperation for certainty. Now, epistemic anxiety is really linked to conspiracism. So if you have high levels of epistemic anxiety, you're more likely to believe conspiracy theories, because conspiracy theories kind of give you a turnkey solution to a solution to what is wrong, or why is everything the way it is.
It's simple, right?
Right, it's simple. But a conspiracy theory, like everyone always says, there's a kernel of truth at the center of a conspiracy theory. That's not true. There's always a lie. There's always a leap of faith at the core of every conspiracy theory. The truth is used to disguise the lie. But actually, what it does is it gives you that fleeting moment of certainty, but then it leaves you empty again. It's intellectual junk food. And it leads people to sort of consume more and more and more conspiracy theories. And that's the problem. And, you know, when you are then immersed in places in which there are no ways to sort of work out what's true or not, in which actually lies get more visibility, that you see them more frequently than the truth, then it leads to, we've got frequency bias in our brains. If we see something more regularly, then we think it's more likely to be true. That's just kind of one of the shortcuts that we use to kind of work out what is true or not, are lots of people saying it. And of course, the way that these platforms work is to actually invert reality so that BS gets more visibility than the truth. Why is it a surprise to anyone that if suddenly the world changed so that BS gets more visibility than the truth, that that would have a massive knock-on impact to a whole array of how human beings feel about themselves, how they feel about each other, how we feel about our nations, our democracy?
Well, and conspiracy theories have been around since we weren't advanced enough as beings to understand what they were, but we had stories we told each other or whatever the case might be. But now, you know, it's not the blood of Christian children in Essex, you know, being drunk by the Jews, right? That gets told in a village and then it gets passed by the village because some guy went to the next village. It's now instantaneous and it's constant. It's ubiquitous. You can't get away from it even if you wanted to. The only way to do it is to turn this off. You and I don't ever Zoom. And you read analog books that were written sometime, you know, in the last 60 years.
Or just, you know, reduce the frequency with which we see nonsense. And one of the things that I realized very early on working in this space is that disinformation and hate are actually really, really interconnected. Like, all hate rests on lies. You know, sometimes when I'm feeling philosophical, I just wonder about what it takes to take, you know, a beautiful child who cannot see evil at all and turn that into someone that thinks that someone is evil because of who they love or the color of their skin or the way they talk. And it takes a lot of BS to actually drive someone to that. What we call the precursors of hate, the ideological precursors of hate, they are now sort of like seeded throughout our society. And anti-Semitism, you know, is the original sin. It's the original hate. You know, Eric Ward, who's a great African-American organizer who said at the Western State Center in the Pacific Northwest, he says that every time you scratch a hate actor, you find an anti-Semite underneath. It doesn't matter if they purport to be anti-African-American or anti-Muslim or anti-whatever. It always comes back to the Jews. Like, even the conspiracy theory about Muslim pedophiles in the UK was that Jews were trying to bring in the Muslim pedophiles to rape the white man, to rape white women, to destroy the white race. It's always about the Jews in the end. And that's always been really interesting to me, is that connection between the two and the ways in which disinformation is a really critical part of how we create these brittle, fragile, warring societies.
I think that's right. And, you know, now I don't want to get overtly political, but that's also what you see now, Imran, is that we have, and as we're recording this, we're just a few hours away from the first Republican presidential debate, where conspiracy theorist in chief will not be in attendance, but his shadow will certainly be there. And whether or not it's January 6th, the 2020 election, now with Vivek Ramaswamy, 9/11, right? the debate stage of one major American political party will be littered with this stuff.
I don't think this is political. I think that this is a social and technological phenomenon. Like a few years ago, I wrote a piece about, you know, trying to urge, it's going to sound really naive now, trying to urge politicians to stop using lies as a tool in the digital space. And my argument was, look, I can see the advantages to you. If you can persuade people of a lie and then tell them you're the only person that understands what they feel and what they think, you know, they'll go to war for you, literally go to war for you. But they will also, you know, they will go and troll your enemies, troll the mainstream media, troll this person, troll that person. It actually gives a competitive advantage to the person willing to weaponize disinformation and hate. And I said, you know, we need multilateral disarmament on using that, with the naive kind of belief that, you know, a moral exhortation to be better could actually make people be better.
So you're sort of the Robert Oppenheimer of digital hate. We can create the bomb. We should give it to everybody else because there's no possible way they'd use it too, right?
Right. And so like my argument is, sure, it can give you short-term advantage, but the problem is that it leads to the end of democracy in the end. And, you know, the 24 election cycle, it is depressing and dispiriting to watch people, again, weaponizing utter nonsense, speaking to these micro segments. And what they're doing is cynical. And you and I have both worked in politics. We know that politics can, you know, in its mechanics sometimes be, you know, incredibly, it's a technical science in many respects, right? And so what they're looking at is micro segments of people with aberrant beliefs that they think that they can knit together into a movement. And the thing is, it's not a new idea. Trotsky talked about this. This is the strategy of bringing together the lumpen proletariat in Trotskyism, of you bring together all the sort of like the, in his view, the underclass of society. So drug addicts, you know, alcoholics, out of work people, prostitutes, and then you create a movement of the lumpen proletariat. The thing is, the strategy of bringing together people who believe completely crazy things and people who hate other people into one movement is that you then get a disinformation and hate political movement. And once they've elected you, you've got to keep feeding the beast. Because actually, if you fail to, you know, if you then say, right, now that I've got power, I'm going to do good things, that's not the way it works, mate, you know, because you lose them. And actually, those people, when they feel that they have been betrayed, they're quite dangerous, as we discovered on January the 6th.
So let's talk about that in the current fight, one of the major current fights you're in. So less than a year ago, Elon Musk takes over Twitter, now X. And I mean, he fires all these people, right? And I don't know the technical aspects of the back end of a social media platform, but the bottom line is he gets rid of most of the people that know what they're doing. He starts to lower the standards. It's sort of like, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and the gold standard. He's deciding, you know, what's worth something, what's worth pushing up, what's worth pulling down, anything that's aimed at him, you know, he takes a special interest to. He claims he's a free speech purist, but if it's something he doesn't like, it disappears. You know, even friends I have who have nothing to do with politics, right, are only on it for, let's say, the niche industry that they're in, Imran, are now getting right-wing stuff, even though they've never espoused any preference or even remote interest, never looked at it, never liked it. So take us through, you know, late 2022, you know, 9-10 months later, to what you've seen on the platform, you know, what Musk's involvement in it is, and how he decided to come for you guys.
Sure. Well, I mean, every social media platform at its core is a business, and it's an advertising business. So 98% of the revenues of Meta come from advertising. And how it works is really simple. They get micro content written by other people and produced by other people. They then apply an algorithm to it, which actually creates the most addictive and entertaining possible news feed, and they serve that up to people. That's all it is. Every social media company is an algorithm, a website slash app, and then the advertising business. And what they realized was actually by prioritizing the stuff with the highest engagement, they could create the most engaging news feed. That makes sense, right? But the problem is they discovered as well, and we know this from the Facebook files, that actually hate content and disinformation content gets more engagement. You know, funnily enough, if I said to you right now, hey, Reed, you know the sky outside? It's bright red. You'd be like, what's going on there? Is it this? Is it that? If I said to you, it's a blue sky outside, you'd go, that's nice, and carry on. And so like, you know, stuff that is nonsensical actually gets more engagement. Stuff that is hateful actually gets people responding to it going, don't be disgusting, or look at this disgusting person, and then sitting around and waiting to see whether or not other people agree with them or disagree with them. It just gets your blood boiling and it keeps your mind engaged.
And if you're the poster, the more people you see that like it, the more you want to do that because it's given you that dopamine rush. So you're now, as the micro content creator, encouraged to do more of it.
So this is how the system works. Like, yes, it actually gave an advantage to hate actors, but they've got to keep the advertisers there. And the advertising is what the real business is. It's not about the eyeballs. They don't care about you, the person watching it or posting on it. You're nothing to them. The person that matters to them is the advertiser. So they realize they have to have community standards. And so all these platforms have these rules, right? You're not allowed to post hate. You're not allowed to post disinformation. You're not allowed to do this, do that, whatever else. And those community standards are meant to be enforced by the platform. They're your responsibility and my responsibility as a user. But therefore, every responsibility comes with a reciprocal right. You expect others to abide by them and someone to enforce the rules.
Almost like society is supposed to be.
Exactly. Reciprocity. And that's how you get out of the Hobbesian state of nature. So you've got these advertisers who want it to be that way. And they are actually the people who are driving forward the community standards. Elon, and the way that it works in law is that that's the only incentive. So under the laws in the US, under the last time we passed laws on the internet that were, you know, serious laws was 1996, something called the Communications Decency Act, Section 230. And Section 230 was called the Good Samaritan Law because it said, look, you are not liable for third-party content on your website, but you also have a duty, therefore, to be a good Samaritan and make sure that if there is hate and disinformation on your website, that you clean it up. Now, that worked when it was like the comment section of a news website, but suddenly social media platforms emerged which said, okay, how about we make that not just an ancillary part of what we do, but that's the business model. We gather loads of people's content. We're not responsible for it at all. And, you know, we'll make sort of small moves towards cleaning it up so it's not too toxic. And what Musk came along and did was said, screw it. I don't care about the Good Samaritan part of the law telling me to be a good guy. The only thing I care about is the get out of jail free card that the other part of Section 230 gives me, because I am not responsible for any of the content on there. And he said, this is about ultimate freedom of speech. I'm going to cut all the trust and say. So what did he actually do? Don't look just at the rhetoric, but also what he did. It's what I, you know, always argue with people like Corbyn and other politicians as well who speak a lot. They talk a lot, but it's what do they do? What he actually did was cut all the trust and safety staff, but then bring in a very high-powered advertising executive to be CEO. And what he said was, I'm going to make sure, he said to advertisers, I'm going to make sure this doesn't descend into a hellscape. But he also said, anyone who was banned before, you know, come back on. So basically, he was sending up the bat signal to hate actors, to misogynists, to homophobes, to people who had posted stuff that was so outrageous.
To the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Right. The IRA the from St. Petersburg. I mean, anyone could come back on. The Ayatollah Khomeini and, you know, Palestine Declassified, which is this disgusting anti-Semitic channel that we've been studying recently at CCDH that, you know, has a home on Twitter. And by putting up the bat signal, of course, these people flooded back. So we wanted to quantify to what extent had that changed the way that the platform felt and looked. So we did a simple study. We said, look, there's a baseline of hateful content that's always going to be there. There's even words like the N-word, which is the worst slur against African-American that's used in a reclaimed way by some black people. And that will be the baseline. So how much did usage of these hate terms increase above the baseline after he took over? And we did a study that showed that the use of the N-word, for example, increased by nearly 200%. So it tripled in the quantum of it, in the amount of it, in the month after he took over compared to the year before. So we took the average amount per day. And we looked at hate speech against gay people, against women, against Jewish people. And we found that all of them were spiking. And we put out this research and said, this is the Musk bump. This is what happens if you basically tell people you're allowed to be as nasty and disgusting as you want, and I won't punish you, and I will allow you to get away with it. And that piece of research was on the front page of the New York Times. It led a lot of advertisers, Musk says himself in his lawsuit, to come to Twitter and say, you need to fix this or we're gone. And then they didn't fix it. And they say they lost tens of millions of dollars of advertising as a result. Now, he says this is CCDH's fault. So he's suing us for it and saying this is your fault for having had the temerity to go and gather the data and do this research. And my argument is, no, sir, I put up a mirror to your platform. And when you don't like what you see in the mirror and others don't like what they see in that mirror, what you do is, what I do when I don't like what I see in the mirror, I have a haircut or I brush my teeth or I lose a few pounds. Instead, he said, you know what? I'm going to sue the mirror. I must be perfect because I'm Elon Musk.
Let me ask you about like Musk personally. I've never met the guy. You know, not that long ago, everybody thought he was sort of a real life, you know, Tony Stark, right? In the real world, he was doing electric cars and he's doing rockets. He's doing the boring thing, right? He's going to make the tunnels, right? And he was this sort of happy-go-lucky weirdo, but, you know, very smart. And in a very short amount of time, it's like, okay, well, this guy's actually nuts. He's an egomaniac, you know, seems to be in line with Russia. And, you know, he has Ron DeSantis on and all those. But also, he doesn't like criticism. As he said, he's a free speech purist, unless, of course, it upsets him, in which case he takes it down. But let me ask you this. Let me bring in Musk personally, your background in corporate finance, and then the people who gave him $44 billion to buy this thing. Like, why would they do that? And why do they let him continue to depreciate the asset they paid so much for?
Well, I mean, with regards to this asset itself, I don't know. And, you know, the truth is that he took the financing from some pretty dangerous people like the Saudis, the people there that, you know, we know what they do when they don't like what you do. So he's been allowed to get away with this, I think in part because he's made so much money for some of those people in the past. But actually, if you want to understand Musk, I think this is about a human being that has accrued so much money that he's just not connected to human beings as they exist right now. One of the ironies of all of this political discussion is that, you know, I think that middle-class people everywhere actually are more connected to each other than we ever could be to the elites of our political parties. And Musk, whether he's advocating for the Democrats as he used to do, or he's advocating for the Republicans as he currently claims to be doing, kind of, not really, I don't know. I've no idea where he is. But this is a man who has nothing to tether him to reality. There's nothing to make him feel like he's connected to the communities that he's so badly serving right now. And he's been allowed to get away with behaving as he wants for too long. But it was interesting. Ronan Farrow just did a profile piece on him and talked about how this is a guy who grew up with a broken family. He went to go and live with his dad. His dad beat the heck out of him. And you can imagine this child looking for security in deception, in money, in, you know, creating this air of like, I am the Wizard of Oz. Like, there's a Wizard of Oz element to him. There's a money will protect me from the degradations that life might visit upon me. I feel incredible sympathy and empathy for that because I know some of that pain myself. It's just there's human beings who react to things in different ways. Like, he reacts to fear by wanting to build up the walls of not caring about what others feel, he claims, while we all know that he's actually deeply sensitive and egotistical and really, really vicious if you don't agree with him, if you go against him, but building up the security of wealth. And there are other people who react to fear. And I, believe me, I know fear. I know the feeling I felt when my friend was killed and thinking that our politics might end up with me or others being killed too. My reaction was the older brother thing of going and doing something about it. I sleep real easily, Reed, because I know that every day I do something to clean up the world that I'm scared of. But he reacted to it by building himself, you know, the biggest moat possible from the rest of humanity, which is this enormous wealth.
And you talked about that with, you see this, some of the same psychological traits of Donald Trump. You mentioned the Saudis and Mohammed bin Salman. Putin fits into this thing, right? I mean, so it does come to a point where absolute power corrupts absolutely, you know, all the wealth in the world, you know, it's, why are the rich people so crazy? Because they can afford to be. And that'd be funny if it wasn't true.
I mean, what's adorable about his lawsuit against us is that he's made all these conspiracies, like he's got Twitter brain, you know, he's literally got Twitter brain. So like that phenomenon where you've been on Twitter for so long, you believe every nonsense that comes along. So in the lawsuit, it says like you are funded by social media companies and by governments. He's trying to explain why I do what I do by saying there's a conspiracy behind it. I am not funded by any government, and I've said that on pain of perjury to the Congress recently. We're not funded by any social media companies. Why I do what I do is not conspiracy theory. It's because my friend died and I needed to change things because I wanted to be part of the solution. And I know that if you have a world which is full of hate speech, you know, we Europeans, living memory of what hate can do, and families of friends of mine were ripped apart by the Holocaust. Like, we know what this unmitigated conspiracism and hate can do to a society. So that's why I did what I did. It's why I do what I do. And he just doesn't understand that because he's got Twitter brain.
Right. So let's talk about some of the other folks you sort of obliquely referenced, which is, so Jim Jordan, member of Congress from Ohio, never been afraid of conspiracy theories himself. Tell us a little bit about what he, because I think he sent you a letter too, right?
Yeah. It happened 2 days after the lawsuit from X Corp. It's almost as though they've been talking to each other and planning this.
Shocking. I'm shocked.
I'd be shocked. Right. So 2 days later, Jim Jordan sent me a letter. Well, I mean, like, keep in mind with Musk, he started about 3 weeks ago by calling me a rat on Twitter, calling my organization evil. Then he called up the chair of my board of directors, my board of trustees, and said, I want to speak to you right now. And then the next day, he sent me a threatening letter, and then a week later, the lawsuit. And then 2 days after the lawsuit came, Jim Jordan, who sent me a letter from Congress saying, I want to have all your contracts with the federal government. Again, one of those conspiracy theories that Musk was referencing. He said, I want to have all your contact with government, all your contact with social media companies, and he wants to know the names of all my members of staff who do it as well. And I wrote back to him a few days ago, well, my lawyer did, saying, we don't have any contracts with the government. We understand that if you took money from the government, how on earth could you talk about conspiracy theories? Because you're literally compromised. You're not objective. You know, I can send you all our correspondence with social media companies. Basically, it's me being quite snarky with them in a very British way that you couldn't tell that I'm being rude. And with the government, most of our contact is just like the Trump administration. Ironically, the Trump administration worked with CCDH. They invited us to speak at conferences with Benjamin Netanyahu, Michael Gove, Mike Pompeo to talk about what we were learning about anti-Semitism online. And they sent me letters saying, thank you so much for helping us to get rid of the scourge of the internet, which is hate speech. And then, of course, when they're out of power, they suddenly pretend that this is a real problem. So they're saying, you must be working with the Biden administration. And what we responded is said, well, no, we work with everyone. That's what bipartisan means. It doesn't mean working with no one. It means just being open to working with anyone.
Right. You've sort of alluded to something a couple of times, Imran. And I find this when we, in our work too, which is, you know, it helps to be experienced. It helps to be talented at whatever you're doing. But I feel like in this kind of work, the thing that's most important is will, the willingness to do it, the willingness to say, I'm up against some very, very bad people who have a lot of power and a lot of money, who are willing to do bad things, have told us or have attempted to do bad things to us. But you get up, as you say, you sleep well, and then you get up every morning and you do it anyway. You do it because you know in your core it's the right thing to do.
Earlier on, my wife and I went for a walk today, and I said to her, you know that the lawsuit, you know, it's going to cost us about $250,000 to defend, and we've raised about $80,000 from small donations on our website, counterhate.com, but, you know, we might go under. And she said to me, baby, you knew that the day you set it up, and you don't set up an organization like CCDH to exist forever. You set it up to make yourself not necessary. And it's something I say to her all the time, but in the heat of the moment of realizing I might lose my 19 colleagues, I might not have a voice anymore because my organization might be crippled by this lawfare. Yeah, you're right. This is about the will to continue to move forwards because you believe it's right. And like one of the things about lying that's really interesting to me and disinformation, like disinformation is lying. I remember like very early on reading, you know, everything I could about the philosophy of lying, of the Augustinian, like, you know, so St. Augustine's theories of duplicity and lying and mendacity. And I realized that I just thought it was wrong. I just think it's wrong. And I think that the way you defeat wrong things, evil things, has always been the will to do good. And I'm willing to do it. You know, I will face down the bullies. And it exacts a personal cost and it exacts a financial cost. But, you know, what else are we going to do? Someone has to do it. And so I'll do it.
No, listen, and I think we feel exactly the same way in our part of the fight, which I think are complementary to one another, right? You have a specific role. But I think the one thing it's interesting you talked a little bit about is that the thing that Musk got most upset about was that you were costing him money. And that's the thing that we saw too a couple of years ago now, when there was a lot of reporting post January 6th about which major corporations and their PACs were still giving to members of Congress who voted against certifying Joe Biden's election. We found out that Toyota North America was one of them. So we ran an ad in New York City, and then we geolocated their top 30 dealerships. And within like 6 hours, they waved the white flag. Great, feels good. But here's the thing, is that they all went back. And that's the other part, is there's the will, but has to be matched with the perseverance, right? Because you realize a win today is certainly not a win forever.
I mean, like, let me just commend the gorgeous tactics that you use there. That is just inspiringly cool. But you're right. And my last sort of philosophical point, the truth is the fight against hate has existed since human beings first existed. And we will have to accept that it will continue to exist as long as human beings exist. But we have been winning that fight. We've been bending the moral arc of history towards justice because of our efforts and our will. And it is our privilege in this generation to be the ones who fight it. It's not an onus that's been put upon us. It's our privilege. It's a good fight to fight. And we won't win it, but we can slowly move that moral arc of history further towards justice. So like, we get to do it now, and we should be happy about that. That's a good thing to do. But you know, in this instance, the irony is that for all the sort of philosophy and the emotion that comes with what might happen if we fail, in the end, CCDH's solution is a market solution. And this is where it goes back to my Merrill Lynch days. It's about a market solution to a market and regulatory failure. When you've got the economics that benefit, that inaction is actually less costly than taking action, because, you know, if you remove content which is dangerous, you actually reduce the amount of engaging monetizable content, and you have to take an action which is a cost. So you reduce revenues, you increase costs, or inaction, you're actually given a get out of jail free card from that by Section 230. So the actual economics mean that your fiduciary duty as an executive is in fact to do nothing. So how do you fix that kind of complete inequity in the economics of it and in the internal calculus of these companies? Well, you create new costs for inaction. And those can be reputational costs. They can be about regulation. So regulation imposes costs and fines if you screw up. Then you can reduce revenues by persuading advertisers or customers of a Toyota dealership not to go and buy there. But these are market and regulatory solutions. And the irony is that these people call us woke activists. And I'm like, no, brother, I'm just Merrill Lynching you.
You know, it's funny as we wrap up here that the only people more sensitive in the case of the market customers than, say, members of Congress or any elected leader who hate to actually hear from their constituents are like the marketing people out of a major corporation. Because I've been in those rooms, right? I did public affairs. I did public relations for these companies. And they're so scared of anything because they want to say whatever they want to say. They want to do very little in real life. But then when you bring that reality to them, Imran, they're like, oh, God, people figured this out, right? They sit in their boardrooms. They think they're smarter than everybody else, right?
And, you know, the reason why at the social media companies, the people who deal with the customers are called trust and safety professionals, because it's about brand safety. So, you know, one of the things that you do is you show them your brand for your, you know, whatever you're selling, your soap or your motor vehicle, appearing next to someone doing a Nazi salute outside the Brandenburg Gate, you know, with 4 million likes in it, and say, well, that's how safe your brand is right now. It is being associated with neo-Nazism, or it's being associated with content that might kill children, or it's being associated with content that might persuade someone to do something terribly harmful to themselves, like start inhaling bleach. I actually met Linda Yaccarino recently.
This is the new CEO of Twitter.
The new CEO of Twitter. In fact, about a few weeks before Elon Musk sued me, she brought me in for a chat. And I said to her, you have the hardest job in Silicon Valley. I said, because on the one hand, you've got to balance your boss who wants you to have more disinformation and hate because it's engaging. And on the other hand, you've got to keep your advertisers happy who want to see less of it. And actually, you're doing a terrible job of it, because what you're trying to do is make sure that there's an algorithm so that your ads don't appear next to the hateful content. But these companies are run by people. People who actually care about democracy, care about tolerance, care about their families. Some of them may be Black, Asian, they may be gay, they may be women. And they're just thinking, no, I just don't want to give money to a company that's so disgusting, that is run by in such a disgusting way. And that's really what's hurt them. The irony is, what's hurt them is not me, it's them.
Absolutely. And again, why is he mad? Because he held up the mirror. And instead of seeing someone who he could be proud of, he saw Dorian Gray and he got upset about it. All right, before we let you go, where can we find you online? Where can we find CCDH's work?
So ironically, I do tweet at @IMI_Ahmed. Our website is counterhate.com. You can find all of our research there. And if you feel so inclined, you could donate there as well to our legal defense fund, which is going really well, but we still need more. And, you know, please keep up to date with what we do. You can sign up for our research to be sent to you. I know our next research report is fascinating. It's on a similar topic to the eating disorder stuff, but it's about young men in particular this time. And it's really, really powerful. Any parent should be thinking about it. You can also go to our website, protectingkidsonline.org, where you can find our guide for parents on how to deal with those tough conversations with kids. I wrote it with Ian, the guy I mentioned earlier, whose 14-year-old daughter took her own life. And it's about how to have those tough conversations about setting boundaries and an agreement on sharing information with your kids about social media so they can tell you what they're seeing and you can tell them what it really means.
Well, amen. And I'm going to now give Imran all of the social media sites I should not be on Twitter and TikTok at Reed Galen, on Threads and Instagram at Reed_Galen_LP. Imran, thanks for joining me. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter at Project Lincoln. And for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. If you want to message the podcast directly, please send an email to podcast@lincolnproject.us. And if you want to personally join the fight to save our nation's democracy, visit jointheunion.us. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.